This is The Point on CAI. I'm Steve Junker. It's Friday, May 24th. Memorial Day weekend is here, and it looks like we start tomorrow anyway with a beautiful day. This is our local news roundup. We'll be discussing the week's top stories with reporters and editors from around the region. Today on the program, we'll be hearing from CAI's Jeanette Barnes and Eve Zuckoff. We'll check in with Ethan Genter at the Vineyard Gazette and Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle. We'll speak with Sam Pollock at the Provincetown Independent and Jason Graziadei of Nantucket Current. CAI's Patrick Flannery speaks with our State House reporter, Katie Lannan, and we'll check in with Anastasia Lennon of the New Bedford Light. Now to some of the news around the Cape, the coast, and the islands. We have arrived at Memorial Day weekend, and that means beach season is officially upon us. And if you're on the Outer Cape, that means time to tune up your shark awareness. In fact, the season's first two white sharks have been spotted off Cape Cod. Shark biologist John Chisholm reported seeing them off Monomoy on Wednesday, and two other shark scientists met with reporters yesterday to talk about the latest research and public awareness. As we head into the summer season, CAI's Jeanette Barnes was there, and she joins us now to talk sharks and more. Hi, Jeanette.
Hi, Steve. Great to be here.
So we know scientists have been tracking white sharks off the Cape for years. They're learning about shark behavior, in part to educate the public about how to enjoy the beaches safely. What are some of the shark detection activities happening this year?
Sure. So one thing that's really popular is the real-time detection of tagged sharks. The state and the Atlantic White Shark Conservancy collaborate on this. So they'll be placing the real-time receiver buoys, five of them, at five different beaches on the Outer Cape and Lower Cape. Those are ahead of the Meadow, LeCount Hollow, Newcomb Hollow, Nauset Beach, and North Beach. And data from those buoys appears on an app called Sharktivity. The scientists heading this up are Megan Winton, who's a staff scientist for the Atlantic White Shark Conservancy, and Greg Skomel, who is the longtime head of shark research for the state. Now, with these real-time buoys, they do point out that the majority of sharks are not tagged. So they don't want people to be over-reliant on that data to determine if it is safe to swim. In terms of other things out there, they also have many more receivers in the water that are not real time because they're less expensive. And those will be data from those will be collected at the end of the season. Some other things they're using on a more limited basis are camera tags they put on the dorsal fin, and also some drone footage. So the camera tags are designed to fall off after about a day. But they give an underwater view of kind of the dorsal fin and the back area of the shark. And it does give researchers a sense of the shark's behavior during that time. So that's some pretty interesting things going on.
I have the Sharktivity app on my phone. In the summer, it can be busy with plenty of sightings. But as you say, most sharks aren't tagged. So what did the scientists have to say about the safety of folks heading out to Cape beaches wanting to swim?
Well, they are learning more every day about what are the highest risk conditions for having an encounter with a shark. They do have some data now that they've been collecting for a number of years from public sightings of incidents where a shark is eating a seal. And so they have like data now on what's the most common water depth, what's the most common time of day. They've recorded these predations in as little as 5 feet of water. More of them have been seen in about 11 feet of water. But one interesting thing the scientist Greg Skomel pointed out is if the seal sees the shark, then the seal is going to win, he says. So the water clarity and visibility are factors as well. And Megan Winton for the Conservancy said in terms of the time of day that these events are happening when the sharks are feeding, it is important to understand that there's no real like safe special time of day. Like if you have the perception that if you go at a certain time of day, you're fine necessarily. It's really that, you know, the sharks are out there all season. They're taking the opportunities when they can find them. So in terms of going into the water, they said it really this is like an individual decision about your own risk tolerance, making your own choices about how deep out you're going to go and things like that.
They really have been focusing on educating the public about shark awareness, and they've also been do you have any, you have some more information about these feeding behaviors off the Cape is what they were looking at. Is that right?
This was a cool chart with the sort of beachgoer sightings I was talking about. So they've re-recorded 57 of these sightings since 2014. All of them are on the lower and outer Cape. And the peak months are July and August. That's when the most sightings happened. Most have been recorded in the afternoon. But again, the scientists are saying these data are skewed by the fact that this is sort of public observer data that's happening when the public is out there. So just because they saw more of them in the afternoon doesn't mean that sharks are not eating in the morning. So like what they want to do is get more unbiased data, possibly from these camera tags and these drones. So they have a data set that's not reliant on what are the times of day people are outside.
Let's talk about Pilgrim Nuclear Power Station now. The question of what is going to happen with the nearly 1 million gallons of radioactive water at the plant, which the decommissioning company Holtec has proposed dumping into Cape Cod Bay. A new round of testing for that contaminated water is now scheduled.
Yes, so that is happening June 4th is the scheduled date for that. What's happening is that Holtec is going to be collecting these water samples. Holtec's the owner of Pilgrim, and the Massachusetts Department of Environmental Protection will be observing the collection of the samples. If they do it the same way they did last year, the samples will then be sent to an outside lab. So it's not as if they're being, tested right there, right next to the pool at Holtec. But one thing that's interesting, this is again, this is for to detect what kinds of contamination are in the water there. It's industrial wastewater inside the plant. We know there's radioactive material and other contaminants. But this year, the state says Holtec has agreed to test for radioactive materials that are harder to detect than they did last year. So this last year, there were some radioactive materials of concern that are harder to find, require a little bit more in-depth work in the testing, and so those weren't done, and some of them will be done this year.
We also got some new information about the tritium that's being evaporated into the air. This is another radioactive material, and it is being evaporated into the air right now from water that's at the plant. Tell us what we learned.
Right. So at this meeting this week of the state panel on Pilgrim, Holtec provided the tritium data for 2023. Tritium, you will remember, is a radioactive form of hydrogen, and it's difficult to remove from the water. It is in the water in the plant. And last year, the amount of radiation from tritium that's going into the air around Pilgrim was about double the previous year. However, when you look at the radiation dose to kind of a hypothetical person who would be receiving that near the plant, the data provided by Holtec shows that that number is 80,000 times lower than the federal government limit, which is set by the US EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency. The amount is also lower than it was the year the plant shut down. But certainly, some people in the community do not want tritium going into the air at all, no matter how much lower it is than the government limit.
We heard a couple of weeks ago about an open meeting law complaint lodged against this advisory panel by one of its own members, David Noyes, who is Holtec's representative to the panel. There was a chance for the panel to address that this week.
That's right. And they did address it. The two individuals who were accused of sending emails to the whole panel in violation of the open meeting law each had their say. Both of them said their emails did not cross that line. But the panel as a whole decided that each of its members is going to sign a document saying that they met the Attorney General's requirements for training and awareness of the open meeting law. So there are a few little things they have to say that they've done there. They've received the guidance and all of that. And so afterward, I asked David Noyes from Holtec, who's the one who filed this open meeting law complaint. I asked him if he was satisfied with that. He said he's going to reserve judgment until he gets a formal written response from the panel chair in writing, which is, that response is required by the law, by the procedures for an open meeting law complaint. So he is waiting for that, but it seems like the members of the panel are going to certainly all get a review if they don't have a recent review on open meeting law.
That is CAI's Jeanette Barnes. Jeanette, thanks so much.
Thank you, Steve.
The Massachusetts Army National Guard was dealt a blow this week on its hopes to build a machine gun range at Joint Base Cape Cod. CAI's Eve Zukoff has the story of how the Guard may have missed a funding opportunity. She joins us now. Hi, Eve.
Hi, Steve.
Walk us through what happened this week.
Sure. So the House Armed Services Committee struck language out of the 2025 National Defense Authorization Act that would have extended funding authorization for this range. So the Massachusetts Army National Guard, to kind of set the stage here a little bit before what happened just this week, the Guard had until September 30th, 2024, that's coming up the end of this summer, to spend about $9.7 million on construction. That covers about two-thirds of the total cost to build the range. But the project has yet to receive final approval from state officials. So the Guard sought to extend the funding that they had appropriated by 1 year, until September 30th, 2025. That was kind of blown. That plan, as far as the House goes, was blown. So now, if the Senate follows the House's lead, the funds will expire in just over 4 months.
So the Guard would have to get a whole new appropriation of money to go ahead if it were going to do that.
Exactly.
And this is a controversial project. Obviously, a lot of push on both sides to try to make this happen or prevent this from happening. Tell us how this particular battle over the finances at the federal level came about.
Yeah, it came about because of Congressman Bill Keating, the Democrat whose district includes the Cape Coast and Islands. He headed this effort to block extending the funds. That was after his office was reportedly flooded with more than 700 emails from constituents saying, look, we're concerned about this range. We're concerned about its potential impacts on the aquifer beneath Joint Base Cape Cod.
Which is what the EPA has underlined already in its draft report.
Exactly.
Concerns about the aquifer.
And that's what Bill Keating ended up citing. He said, you know, the range, according to the EPA and its draft report, could contaminate the region's drinking water. And so he said he had initially hoped to put forward an amendment that would require the completion of the EPA's review, that finalization of the draft, as a condition of extending the authorization. But it was made clear by the majority party, the Republicans, that such an amendment would not be allowed. So he concluded that, you know, the aquifer is too important. We need a completed sole source aquifer review by the EPA. And so we have to allow the EPA to finish their work, finalize this review before this project takes additional steps towards construction.
Hmm. Reactions? Have you heard anything since the news broke?
Well, we reached out to the Guard right away, and we didn't get a comment. You know, we can assume the 700 people who emailed Keating are pretty happy today.
Hmm.
We also talked to Andrew Gottlieb, executive director of the Association to Preserve Cape Cod. He's been vocal and a pretty effective opponent of the range. He offered thanks and appreciation to Keating in a statement. Mark Forrest, our Brownsville County Commissioner, said Congressman Keating has really done us a service by having this language stricken. But now the work begins again, because the opponents of the range are going to be talking to the Senate and Senators Warren and Markey to ensure that what just happened in the House takes place in the Senate. As Mark Forrest said, we are still not out of the woods.
Let's switch gears here and check in on another story that you wrote this week. This is on a North Atlantic right whale found dead off the coast of Canada. What do we know?
Yeah, so this dead right whale was found about 75 miles southwest of Nova Scotia. A Transport Canada aerial surveillance plane released these photographs that show, strangely, only the lower half of the whale's body. But that's because that's all that's left. There was kind of some misinformation, honestly, floating out there that, you know, they only wanted to show part of it to obscure something. It's actually not true. It's not totally clear why there's only half the whale left. It may have something to do with the decomposition process, one scientist told me, maybe how the whale was killed. This is kind of like a niche of study that someone will be looking into. And the cause of death has not been determined, and the carcass hasn't been recovered. It may not be recovered. It's in a very strange state.
So right whales, we know they come here in the kind of the winter months and they feed, and then in the spring they move off. Do we still have right whales in local waters?
Yeah, well, as you said, the season has kind of ended earlier this month as far as when we see like 2/3 of the total right whale population in local waters. And again, that's really substantial because there's about 350 of these animals left on the planet. Now that they have like mostly left, it's local lobster season, but there may still be stragglers of right whales, particularly south of the islands. It's hard to know without regular aerial surveys, but for the most part, it's believed that probably the majority of them have started to go north where there are fewer protections, unfortunately, for right whales as they get more into Maine and then Canada. And that's where we've seen more of the problems in the last few years.
Okay, one more sea life story I want to talk to you about today. You'll be following efforts to count spawning horseshoe crabs. Now, what can you tell us?
Yes. Okay, so there is an annual volunteer-based spawning beach survey that's taking place at a bunch of beaches along the south coast, Cape Cod, the islands. There's 16 different locations. And the survey occurs at high tide 2 days before the day of and 2 days after the new and full moons of May and June. I am heading out to kind of watch this happen. I watch surveyors count the number of male and female crabs that fall within a survey area, which is within 5 meters of the shoreline. And there could be a lot of crabs. There could be a little. In 2021, this is the most crabs, horseshoe crabs, ever seen in a survey. They found nearly 3,000. Mm. So I might be getting some cool pictures that we'll put up online today.
That is CAI's Eve Zukoff. Eve, thanks.
Thank you.
This is the news roundup on The Point. I'm Steve Junker. We're going to take a quick break now. When we come back, we'll speak with Ethan Genter of the Vineyard Gazette. Stay with us. This is the news roundup on The Point. We're talking about the top local stories of the week with reporters and editors from around the region. I'm Steve Junker. The offshore wind company Vineyard Wind has been busy. While it continues to install its 62 turbines south of Martha's Vineyard, it has also been building an operations facility on the island. Ethan Genter of the Vineyard Gazette got an exclusive look inside of that. He joins us now. Hi, Ethan.
Good morning, Steve.
Vineyard Wind has built this significant new building in Vineyard Haven on the road that Google Maps used to identify as Beach Road. lots of people have probably seen it from the street, but for those of us who haven't, give us a sense of it from the street.
Yeah, so it's just off the ferry, just down the street there in Vineyard Haven. And it's kind of this, the first thing you kind of notice when you're going by is just how high off the ground it is. I think it was like 15 to 18 feet off the ground. Because of floodplain regulations around new construction.
So it's raised up and there's actually parking underneath the building. Is that right? Or there will be?
Yeah, Vineyard Wind plans to have their employees park underneath the building. So it's kind of this little parking garage in Vineyard Haven here.
And that actually resolves one tricky thing about everything that happens there downtown, which is to try to figure out parking for people who are going to be working there.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, if anyone's been to the island, parking a lot of time is never easy, likewise in Woods Hole. So it's definitely kind of solved the place. And, you know, there's only so many spots on the vineyard where you could have this kind of building that's also close to Vineyard Wind's also going to have a marine terminal where they're going to have boats and employees that'll shuttle out onto the turbines.
Okay, so it's a fairly big, long building fronting on Beach Road there, and it's raised up over the street with this sort of elevated so that, you know, it can wash through underneath, essentially, where the parking's going to be. What is going to happen in this building? You got to go inside. Tell us what happens in the space.
Yeah, so this building is going to be where, you know, the kind of the daily runnings and kind of maintenance of these turbines is going to be. There's a bunch of office space. There's going to be just kind of like a control room where you've got a bunch of monitors and people are going to be kind of looking at these things. And there's a giant warehouse, 18 foot high warehouse in this building where they're going to store a bunch of spare parts for all these turbines. Because, I mean, as you can imagine, these massive, they're 3 times taller than the Statue of Liberty, will need quite a bit of handling and maintenance over the years.
So they are in the process of getting these 62 turbines built offshore. And at some point when they're all up and running, they'll be monitored from this building. How many people does Vineyard Wind think will be working on the island at this one facility?
So they've said kind of 90 people overall. That's always kind of a little bit of a moving target. It's kind of 30 people at a time is kind of what I've been told, kind of working daily. I mean, they're going to be there a lot. I mean, as you can imagine, this isn't like, okay, just close the door and walk away at 5 o'clock. These things are kind of constantly running out there if the wind's going. So yeah, that's kind of what they're imagining.
And it just raises the question of where people live. Are they people going to be on the island then?
It's probably going to be a little bit of a mix. They have secured some housing down in Vineyard Haven. There's a bunch of apartments nearby that they've bought. I talked to one guy who lives in one of them. But yeah, some people will be coming from off island. I mean, we've got the New Bedford and the Woodshull Ferry, obviously. So yeah, it seems like it's going to be a mix. They're still kind of hiring up. They've only hired about 30 people, was what I was kind of told. So we'll see kind of exactly what the mix breaks down to.
And the company that built the turbines, General Electric, they're also going to have an office in this same building so that they can kind of watch their own turbines, because these are really front-edge technology.
Yeah, exactly. GE is built these, and they kind of handle these for the first few years to make sure, everything's working right. These are, a lot of technologies that are coming, been used over in Europe a lot, but over here in the US, this is really kind of the first very large project in the US. So they're going to be hanging out down here in Vineyard Haven for a bit to kind of make sure everything's running smoothly.
This is just one part of Vineyard Wind's presence on the island. Just briefly, kind of describe some of the other places they are on the island as they're putting together this big facility and going to be running it.
Yeah, so they also, I mentioned before, they're going to have that marine terminal. There's a bit, essentially a big dock, and that's to the left. If you're coming in on the steamship ferry, you can see it over on the left side near the bridge. And then they're also going to have a helicopter hangar down over at the airport in the middle of the island. And that's helicopters. So like, if you need a quick trip, it's a few hour boat ride down to the turbines that are about 14 miles away. And so if you hop in a helicopter, it's about 15 minutes.
Have they offered you a helicopter ride yet?
Not yet. We're still trying to wrangle that.
And it seems like everything else in the vineyard has a little merchandise operation. They're going to have a little storefront there.
I don't think so. No one mentioned that. Yeah, no one said I visited Vineyard Wind Teas are coming, but I'll keep you posted, Steve.
Ethan Genter of the Vineyard Gazette. Ethan, thanks so much.
Yep, take it easy.
Short-term rentals, we couldn't go a week without talking about them. On the Lower Cape, some towns are seeing a real disparity between the number of short-term rentals registered with the state and registered with the town. Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle joins us to explain this. Hi, Tim.
Hi, Steve.
We're talking about properties rented on platforms like Airbnb. If you're renting out your home on a short-term basis, you're supposed to register that, is that right?
Yeah, since 2019, owners of short-term rentals have had to register with the state. That's when the state expanded the room tax. The occupancy tax to include short-term rentals, and in some towns they've been using that money to that extra revenue for to build up affordable housing funds and things like that. But three of the four Lower Cape towns have local registries where short-term rental owners are supposed to get a permit, basically fill out a form. In Chatham, there's a fee. In other towns, there isn't a fee. And the basic premise behind these local registries is for the local town officials to have some sort of database where they can keep track of these short-term rentals and make sure that they're complying with health and safety codes. And when we looked at what were registered for short-term rentals on the State Department of Revenue website, you can go right on there and you can put in your town and get a list of all the short-term rentals in your town by address. And we looked at those numbers and then we looked at the local registries and we found a pretty big disparity there between the numbers that are registered with the state and the numbers that are registered locally.
Talk a little bit about why, you know, what the sense is about, I guess I'm curious why towns are so leaning into their independent registry from the state. Part of this is about collecting money from these short-term rentals?
Yes, exactly. Part of it is that, like Chatham instituted a 2%, they raised the room occupancy tax by 2% when the short-term rentals came on in order to use that revenue dedicated to Chatham that uses it for a couple of sources. One is for affordable housing, and another is to help fund operation of the town's elementary school. And, I think, you know, the local officials were looking for something that where they could have a little bit more control over who is renting short term, not really, you know, controlling who can and can't, but being able to respond to complaints and say, you know, this house and your, you know, someone calls and has a complaint about a noise or something like that, they could determine if that house is where the complaint is issued about is a short-term rental. And if it is, they can go in and they can do inspections to see if they're not violating health and safety codes. As you remember, Steve, in the last few years, there's been sort of an emphasis on the number of short-term rentals have been increasing because of the lucrative nature of being able to rent out a house for short-term times during the summer. But it's also led to overcrowding where, you know, people see, you know, you see advertisements for houses that sleep 20 that, you know, only have a couple bedrooms in them.
So,
and that's one of the major things that, you know, towns are trying to get at.
So there's a state list, towns have their own list, and obviously towns are now working to sort of close the gap there. What's happening?
Yeah, at least in Chatham has hired a new housing inspector whose job it is to oversee the short-term rental list and to compile a list of the rentals that are registered with the state and the town and make a comparison and then start to sort of chip away at getting the folks who haven't registered yet to do so locally. And, you know, to be fair, the local registries are new. They've only been in place this is the first season for most of them, whereas the state's registry has been up and running for about 4 years. So, you know, town officials are taking sort of a laid back approach to this and not, you know, being, you know, draconian and enforcing this registry regulation. But they, because it's new, and there's no penalty at this point for not registering, but they're saying that if this continues and there's a big disparity, you know, then they may take some further action about that.
It's Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle, where you can read all about it. Tim, thanks so much.
Thank you, Steve. Have a good weekend.
Year-round rentals in Provincetown are rarities. One group of older buildings called Nappyville has supplied at least a dozen of these, but the buildings have fallen into disrepair, and now the town is stepping in. Sam Pollock of the Provincetown Independent is here to explain what's going on. Hi, Sam.
Hi, Steve. How's it going?
Good. Sam, the town is citing health concerns here and is taking what seems like a big step, proposing to seek receivership for this property. I guess start by explaining what would that mean?
Yeah. So essentially this property, it's a 12-unit property that has been under extensive health orders from the town since 2020, you know, for backed up cesspools, for inadequate heating in units, hazardous electrical work, the list kind of goes on. The property owners have neglected to sort of adhere to the health orders and bring the property up to this state sanitary code. And so the town has been holding public hearings since March on how to enforce these health orders. And last week, the town decided to take the path of receivership, which would, you know, require petitioning housing court to enforce their orders, and if the property owner still does not, you know, take the step to repair the property, then appointing a receiver who is a sort of a third party entity to stand in the shoes of the owner to make those repairs.
What happens to the folks who are living there now?
Yeah, that's a good question. It's sort of unclear. It's kind of up to the discretion of the receiver when they're appointed. So right now that there are four vacant units in the 12-unit property. What the Town of Provincetown's town council suggested could happen is, you know, sort of shuffling around of tenants, so that properties, units that are vacant right now can be fixed first, and then a sort of shuffle happens where until all units are repaired.
This is not the first time we've talked about this property. This property has been kind of in the public eye for a little while now, in part because it is one of these rare groupings of year-round housing right in the middle of Provincetown. And also the way that it's owned now, it's kind of the original owner has passed away and it's being managed by somebody. By explain a little bit about what's going on here, because it's complicated.
Right. Yeah. So the property was originally owned by a beloved restaurateur, Anton Nappy Van Derrick. But Nappyville is named after him. And him and his wife owned Nappy's restaurant, a restaurant in Provincetown, and a bunch of residential properties around town, where they housed, you know, their employees and other friends and locals of theirs. It was sort of the last stronghold of this sort of old Provincetown, where, you know, there was year-round rentals and the sort of if ramshackle sort of very quaint properties. But Nappy died in 2019, and his, bestowed everything to his wife. But his wife, who has dementia, was declared unfit by the court to manage the estate. And so what happened was their financial advisor won control of the estate and also conservatorship of Nappy's wife, Helen. And so essentially, ever since, has been the sole person in control of the properties around town.
Very briefly here, what happens next? They're going to look for somebody to take over the receivership of this?
Yeah, so what happens next is that the town is going to work with its council to sort of develop a petition the Southeast Housing Court to enforce these regulations. It's unclear what that means, what that will look like in court, how the court will enforce those health orders. But most likely what will happen is then the court will work to find a receiver who is usually a property management company or a nonprofit, essentially to take over the property.
That's Sam Pollock of the Provincetown Independent. Sam, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Steve.
You're listening to the News Roundup. I'm Steve Junker. We're going to the break now. When we come back, we'll hear from Jason Grazide of Nantucket Current. Stay with us. This is the local news roundup on The Point. I'm Steve Junker. We are talking about the top local stories of the week with colleagues in the print and digital media. Nantucket held its town elections this week. Jason Grazide of Nantucket Current joins us with an update on that and more. Hi, Jason.
Good morning.
Jason, an interesting list of proposals on the ballot, that some of them got support from voters, others were rejected. What stood out for you?
Yeah, it was really a mixed bag for the spending proposals that the town put forward on the ballot, and this is obviously requires a debt exclusion override to raise taxes above the limits of Proposition 2.5. So, you know, some of the things that did pass, expanding a $5 million override for expanding our landfill cell, obviously a huge priority for the town, something that's necessary. You know, there was a number of, you know, vehicles for town departments, even things like reconstruction of the town's tennis courts at Jetty's Beach. Now, that, you know, people were sort of a little perplexed that, you know, in some cases the tennis courts got funded, whereas other things that were had to do with housing for town employees, there was two big ticket items that would have converted properties or set aside funding for feasibility and design costs that were shot down. There was a study and a design cost for relocating the town's DPW facility that was shot down, a auxiliary building for the fire and police departments was also defeated. So it was hard to sort of determine the rhyme or reason other than that voters were, you know, they've seen their taxes go up the last couple years quite a bit as other spending proposals have gone through. So it was sort of a mixed bag for the town there at town meeting and at the ballot.
A couple of other interesting stories I want to touch on this week. The historic Main Street fountain, which we know got demolished last fall in a car incident. It may be installed before summer really gets underway. You have an update on this.
Yeah, that's the hope, according to DPW Director Andrew Patnode, who we talked to. We reached out to the company that was actually hired to repair the fountain. This is the Cassidy Brothers Forge in Rowley, Mass. And they've had the pieces of the fountain, as you said, which was destroyed last October by the driver of a white truck. And they've had this for a number of months. We reached out to them and they shared some pictures, which you can see on our website, of this historic Main Street fountain getting repaired. They said that last week they completed their repairs. So we reached out to the DPW and they are hoping to have it up for the summer, but there's also, you know, getting it back by ferry, scheduling the electricians, the masons, the physical reinstallation, all that stuff. So we hope to see that landmark back on Main Street soon.
It's neat pictures of the pieces of that fountain actually there at the foundry getting reconstructed. And if, for anyone who had seen that video of the truck running into that, it almost seems unbelievable that they're able to rebuild that fountain one more time.
Yeah, and this is the same company that rebuilt it in 2020 after it was, again, toppled by a motor vehicle, not as in dramatic fashion as the one last October, but they've done this before and are doing it again. A couple people said, you know, can they make us a spare?
Hey, Memorial Day is a big celebration traditionally on the island with the Fagawi race happening again this year and kind of a return of one more pre-COVID tradition associated with this.
Yeah, exactly. So the annual Fagawi race, which is the charity sailboat race from Hyannis to Nantucket. This is its 53rd year. It was back last year for the first after taking a three-year break around the pandemic. But what was missing was sort of the festivities and the party tent that typically is part of the end of the race in Nantucket, where they set it up at the Candle Street property right there in downtown. That is coming back this year, a little bit smaller. They don't have full access to the property because of some of the buildings down there that are in disrepair at the Candle Street lot. But getting back to normal, the organizers are really excited to have that aspect of the event come back. You know, we'll be seeing the boat basin full of sailboats on Saturday as they arrive.
It's Jason Graziade of Nantucket Current. Jason, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me on. Appreciate it.
This week at the State House, there's talk of how artificial intelligence could influence an election. And just in time for Memorial Day, there's action on Beacon Hill to help veterans access their benefits. Our Morning Edition host, Patrick Flannery, spoke with our State House correspondent, Katie Lannon, about these stories and more. Here's their conversation.
Hello, Katie.
Hey, good morning.
Here we are already, Katie. Memorial Day weekend is upon us, a time to remember fallen service members. The House this week did pass a bill to improve access to benefits for veterans. What can veterans expect to immediately improve?
Well, immediately is always a tricky thing to consider on Beacon Hill because the Senate would have to go along as well. But assuming that happens, as soon as this summer, the annuity for disabled veterans would increase up to $2,250. That's $2,250 annually. And that would rise again next year. There's also measures in there that aim to make it easier for veterans to get access to behavioral health care and tax incentives for employers who hire veterans. If you're not a veteran, the thing you might see the most come out of this, you might be most visible to you, is there's a requirement that bridges and landmarks would be lit up gold on Memorial Day in honor of the sacrifices of Gold Star families, those families who have lost a loved one in military service.
Katie, not long ago, we were talking about different versions of how the $58 billion state budget could end up looking. Governor Healey had her version, the House put one forward, and now the Senate is proposing its idea of what spending should look like. What are the key differences?
One of the big differences that's going to have to be hashed out between the House and Senate is the different plans for spending the millionaires' tax money, especially now that that new income surtax is expected to generate almost $2 billion, which is more than budget writers anticipated. So one of the things the Senate wants to do that they've been highlighting during their debate this week is use that money to make community college free for all students in Massachusetts. There's also differences between how the House and Senate want to fund transportation, with the Senate wanting to do more for regional transit authorities, while the House really wants to go big on MBTA improvements. So there'll be a lot to iron out there as closed-door negotiations proceed between the two branches of the legislature after this week.
And I really want to get to this one. Part of the budget proposal involves whether to address AI and how artificial intelligence could sway an election. You know, deep fakes are a problem, as you've reported, Katie. We've heard of those robocalls claiming to be President Biden's voice. What else is at stake here?
Yeah, this is really interesting because especially when you consider the accessibility of AI, there are people who are concerned that when you particularly look at local and state elections that are often decided on very small margins, it'd be easy for people to influence voters to think something false about a candidate or to just stay home, to not vote, to imply that there'd be hassles going to the polls. So the House in its budget has a language that would require disclaimers on AI-generated content and political messaging. The Senate is considering a similar proposal that would also time limit it to 90 days before an election. So that'll be something that's another one of those differences that the branches will have to iron out. But it is something that, you know, people who want to see action here are talking about this in big terms, saying that democracy depends on people knowing what's true.
And speaking of the election and Joe Biden, for that matter, the president was just in Boston this week, wasn't he?
That's right. He was in New Hampshire mostly and then came to Boston for a trio of fundraisers, including one hosted by Governor Healey. That's, of course, typically the move of Democratic presidents and presidential candidates to go to New Hampshire where there are more swing voters and then come here to Massachusetts for the fundraising aspect. But I think we can expect to see Governor Healey, who has a role in the Biden campaign, only become more prominent as a surrogate as the election inches closer.
We've only just begun. Katie Lannon from the State House, as always, thanks for joining us each week.
Thank you.
And that is CAI's Morning Edition host, Patrick Flannery, speaking with our State House correspondent, Katie Lannon. You're listening to the News Roundup. I'm Steve Junker. Installing massive wind turbines in offshore waters is no easy engineering feat, making the challenge significantly more tricky. A number of locations show a type of soil much different than sand. It's called glauconite. And fortunately for us, we have Anastasia Lennon of the New Bedford Light to explain what's going on. Hi, Anastasia.
Hi, Steve. Thanks for having me.
Glauconite, it's a kind of green mineral. Why is it such a problem?
Yeah, so you described it well. It's a very old mineral that formed in marine environments, you know, going back to the age of the dinosaurs. And it's not as well understood as more common sort of materials like a clay or a sand. It sort of behaves like both, and it looks like a sand, but when it's exposed to pressure, its grains sort of disappear and it can become clay-like. And why this matters for offshore wind development is when they're installing these piles that hold up the turbine foundations, that great pressure and shaft resistance from the pile rubbing against these grains turns it into a very sticky clay, which creates more resistance and can make it such that they can't install the piles to target depth, meaning they wouldn't be able to get the turbines in those locations. So it's causing a challenge and a bit of a headache for wind developers now along the East Coast.
So people can think of, we think of a wind turbine kind of on a post that's driven down into the ground. That's a monopile,
correct,
a single post. But engineers have now developed some alternatives to the monopile that may be useful here in dealing with glauconite soils. One of these, which is going to be tried out, is called the suction bucket. And you do a nice job laying this out, explaining what this is. Explain how this works.
Yeah, so there are, of course, other alternatives to foundations aside from monopiles that have existed, but they just haven't been used as frequently in offshore wind development. So one of these alternative foundation bottoms is a suction bucket. And if you want a picture like a can of Coca-Cola with half of it shaved off. So you just sort of have a can or a bucket and imagine putting it into soil. And what happens underwater is they install this by sucking the water out of this bucket. So there's that pressure difference that causes it to sink into the ground and get secured. And so it's shallower than monopiles. It doesn't go as deeply. Some people really like the idea of suction buckets because the method is quieter. It's not as loud as pile driving for monopiles. So some people are calling it a quiet foundation, and they really like the idea of it in terms of protecting, marine mammals and species. As you may know, pile driving, there are restrictions of when it can happen, during which seasons, and if any marine mammals are sighted, you can't do it because it's loud. So this could be an alternative that not only helps perhaps with glauconite, but could help maybe developers be more flexible as they don't maybe need to have as many workarounds or mitigation measures with the quieter suction buckets.
There are a lot of these offshore wind projects in different stages of development now, south of the Vineyard and kind of going down the East Coast. How big is the glauconite problem? How widespread is it?
So that's a good question and one I'm still trying to get answers to. So we've been digging, no pun intended, filing lots of FOIA requests. The issue is that the data collected on glauconite is proprietary. And it was kind of a surprise to the government as much as it was to developers. The Outer Continental Shelf really hadn't been much explored. It's so expansive, so there's very limited data to begin with. And so when developers are conducting their geotechnical surveys after they've secured the leases, it's when they're finding out about this substance. And so they have information on it. It's not necessarily public data. It's information I've had to request and really struggle to get in some cases. So it's still sort of an unknown as to how widespread it is, how many developers are going to encounter it. We may run into more as they continue and start their survey work. But so far, we've confirmed that there are 4 leases along the East Coast that have run into it.
Obviously, offshore wind is new for us in North America, but off the coast of Europe, they've been doing offshore wind for a while. How common are suction buckets and other types of foundations, alternative types to monopile, where in Europe?
Yeah, so monopiles are still the main foundation overseas in Europe. There has been some suction bucket testing and some use, but I think in my article, I cited a figure a few years ago. I think it was about 80% or more of the foundations were monopiles. And so a lot of what's going to happen now is they have to test or ground truth these foundations and see if they're feasible alternatives. And, they might end up costing more money if they require more steel. The bottom line is it can happen. You can use these alternatives, but monopiles have been, the real tried and true foundation for most projects here and overseas.
Is there one project here or company here that's right now kind of racing ahead with this that's going to test the suction buckets?
Yep. So Beacon Wind, it was a joint project between Equinor and BP. Now it's fully owned by BP. And so they are going to be test installing a single suction bucket at around 25 locations in its lease south of Martha's Vineyard. And so we'll have to wait for the results on that. But that's the developer and project that's sort of forging ahead to try and see if this technology would be feasible.
That is Anastasia Lennon of the New Bedford Light explaining more than we even thought we might have to know about how to install wind turbines off the coast here. Anastasia, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
That is the news for today. I want to thank all my guests. We heard from CAI's Jeanette Barnes and Eve Zuckoff. We spoke with Ethan Genter of the Vineyard Gazette and Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle, Sam Pollock at Provincetown Independent, and Jason Graziadei of Nantucket Current. We heard from CAI's Patrick Flannery with our State House reporter Katie Lennon and Anastasia Lennon there from the New Bedford Light. Big thank you to Dan Treidle for engineering the program. If you climb to the top mast of this leaky old news roundup frigate, you'll see his initials carved there high over the deck, DT. He's one of the original crew. He's seen it all. Thanks, Dan. Thank you for listening in Woods Hole. I'm Steve Junker. Talk to you next week.